This morning, Brother Irwin has chosen the topic, the olive leaf stomata, which means mouths in the Greek. And it's a PowerPoint talk. Brother Irwin.
Good morning, brethren. The title of our remarks are Olive Leaf and Stomata. I'm sure you're familiar with the olive leaf, but you've probably never heard the word stomata. It is a Greek word, and we will give a definition in about 35 minutes, and we hope that you will never, ever forget this definition. Years ago at our Chicago convention, Brother Stuart Sowers mentioned that we should study the rules of salvation and form an opinion about Judas. We realize that God is the judge, and he does not err in his judgments. So the question would come up, why bother to spend time thinking about Judas? As years passed by, I decided to follow Brother Stewart's advice. I started to study the rules of salvation and familiarize myself with some of the basic principles. I reached the satisfying conclusion for myself, I'm going to emphasize for myself, that Hebrews 9:22 solved this issue. And Hebrews 9:22 states, "And according to the law, one may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness." No one was released from the Adamic death until Pentecost. My conclusion is that it's impossible to go into second death if you are not released from Adamic death. We are not denying responsibility to light demonstrated by Jesus. When Judas comes back in the millennial age, it is possible he may not be able to overcome. This study and research proved to be a great blessing to me. The reason we are mentioning this point is that I made a similar decision in regards to global versus local flood. The question comes to mind, why bother to spend time in this area? I decided I would do some research on the subject and to evaluate scriptures regarding this topic. I have always favored a local flood due to the assumption that God would not destroy any more than necessary. An anecdote of a trial between a rich man and a poor widow. The judge decided in favor of the poor widow. Thus, the judge had to find a law in her favor. After spending time researching a book and research papers on the computer, I have learned more than I dreamed of learning. I will now present some of my research results to you and let you be the jury, so to speak, and see if you agree or disagree with the material. On the map, you will notice that this would be the birth of civilization. And we have Egypt here, Mediterranean Sea, this would be Turkey, and this would be Iraq, which would be the birth of civilization. And you will notice that we have the city of Ur, this would be where Abraham lived, and that's where God called him. So the Mesopotamia area started out with the Sumer area, which would be the darker shade. As time went on, the population expanded, and we came to the Akkad area. And then later on, it kept growing and growing. It went all the way up north. Where you see the arrow, this would be the Persian Gulf. And right between these two rivers, you have two rivers here, this is called the Mesopotamian area, and it's a Greek word, which means between the rivers. And you will notice that the mountains are plural from Genesis 8:4. And in these articles, it would be plural. And you'll see that this is a complete mountain range. So we start out with an article written by A.O. Hudson in a Bible Student Monthly, which would be the May-June 1979 issue. And he comes up with the key thought that the mountains landed on this complete range that we have here at the present time. And on the bottom, you'll see a city called Fera. And I'm going to mention, according to tradition, now this is tradition, it mentions that this is where Noah lived, and this is where he built the ark. It'd be halfway between Babylon over here and the Persian Gulf on the bottom. Next, you'll notice that we have ziggurats. Now, ziggurats are religious temples, and the face of the ziggurats pointed toward the mountain called Kui Enarim. And you remember, Daniel started the precedent that when he was in Babylon, he prayed toward Jerusalem. And after the flood, the Babylonian priests prayed in the direction of their ancestors. And you will notice on this that both of these lines go right to a mountain called Kui Enarim, and that's where Brother A.O. Hudson felt the ark landed. And it's very important now that when we see the next slide, you will notice that we have this would be a ziggurat. You go up these stairs, and then you go all the way up this spiral column, and the face of the ziggurat pointed toward the east. And this would confirm the scriptures that we have in the Septuagint, the King James, the Moffat, and the Scribner's commentary on Genesis 11:2, all state the fact that it came to pass as they moved from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, or Shinar, and they dwelt there. Now, this would confirm A.O. Hudson's thought that the scripture stated that they came from the east. So this would be the east, and you'll notice that the mountains from the other charts that we showed, that the mountains would be from 100 to 150 miles away. This was a very flat alluvial plain. There were no hills and no mountains in this area. And we'll also like to point out that from Mount Ararat, which we'll illustrate later on, it would be way up here, and you'd have about 125 miles of mountains before you would even get to the Mesopotamian area. And from here, the total distance to Mount Ararat would be over 600 miles, so the purpose of the ark was just to float. And we also feel that, as we mentioned before, after the flood, you will notice that we wanted to mention that these mountains were very, very big. And you see this darker area, this would correspond to the dark area, which would show that the mountains here were very, very high. So Mount Ararat would be in this area. In order to get down to the Babylonian area, you'd have to travel 125 miles to get down into Mesopotamia. On this picture, you will notice that Genesis mentions no geographical place names beyond the greater Mesopotamia until chapter 10. God rebuked the human race after the flood at the Tower of Babel for not spreading out. And in Genesis 9:4, it mentions, "And they said, come, let us build for ourselves a city, and a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And let us make a name, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth." So mankind loved to live in that area. We are locked in mentally to think a certain way because we read a translation in a fixed way. We are going to examine the possible alternative translation of three words, and you will see the dynamic effect it has on our conclusion. Our first consideration is by William Tanner, who is a geologist. It is commonly assumed that Noah would see mountains being flooded because the ark reported landed on one. But the Hebrew word har, plural harim, plural possessive hair, translated as mountains in Genesis 7:20 and 8:4, can also mean hills, and is so translated in many other places in the Old Testament, including Genesis 7:19, and this would be a King James Version, and all the high hills. There are no mountains in the southern Tigris-Euphrates Valley where Noah lived, only higher or lower hills on a flat alluvial plain. The nearest mountains are beyond the horizon. Noah could have seen hills being flooded in Euphrates, but not mountains. It is traditionally translated as mountains because there was a mountainous region known as Ararat that has long been identified with the Armenian Mountains in what is now eastern Turkey, a region called Urartu by the Assyrians. But if the land where Noah's barge grounded was not in a mountainous region, then it could not have been in Ararat Urartu. Ancient scribes who wrote that the barge grounded in the mountains of Ararat made a mistake of identification. The ambiguous Akkadian word for hill, mountain, was shadu, and is so used in the Gilgamesh epic. I'd like to explain that the Gilgamesh epic is the Babylonian account of the flood, and it is very accurate in many ways. Shadu could mean a low hill, only a few feet high. In the Gilgamesh epic, the place where the ark grounded is usually translated Mount Nisr. But the word Shadu translated as mount could also mean hill or mound. Nisr could be a corruption of the Akkadian word Nisirtu, meaning hidden, inaccessible, or secluded. The Gilgamesh grounding place is therefore vague, saying only that the ark grounded on a secluded hill or mound. A sandbar in a swamp would qualify. With this information, one must choose hill, not mountain. Hill is the preferred translation anyway, unless there is strong evidence to the contrary. Also, with this information, one must render all in terms of the knowledge available to Noah and his contemporaries, rather than in terms of a modern atlas. And finally, land is obviously a better translation than earth, and Rotherham confirms the earth translation found in Genesis 7 and 8. The Hebrew adjective gaboa means high, exalted, or lifted up. It applies to any elevation above the plain, from a landmark hill to a Mount Ararat. Genesis 7:19 describes Noah's inability to see anything but water, horizon to horizon from his view on the ark's upper deck. If the ark were floating anywhere near the middle of the vast Mesopotamian plain or water, as deep as 200 to 300 feet, no hills or mountains would be visible from it. Noah could see nothing but water. The high mountain ranges surrounding the Mesopotamia Valley would lie beyond Noah's line of sight. His view was limited, of course, as everyone else's, by the Earth's curvature, atmospheric condition, aging eyes, and other factors. So what we'd like to emphasize is that when Noah built the ark in this area, when the ark would go up, I talked to Brother Russ Martin, who would be knowledgeable in this area. When the ark would go up, he could probably see 15 miles away, and the curvature of the earth would cut him off. So he would not see these mountains, which were from 100 to 150 miles away. It's possible he might be able to see a few hills that would be toward the east. If you look up in Strong's, the word 2022 for mountains, it means hair, H-A-R, and it does mean a mountain or a range of hills, sometimes used figuratively, hill, country, or mount. Next, we're going to consider the word earth. We're not talking about the planet earth. And you'll notice that the word eretz means land, ground, dirt, or country. And edema means ground, soil, land, region, or country. Either one means earth, that is, dearth or soil, but neither means the planet earth. We're not talking about the planet earth. If we look up in Strong's, a concordance at 776, this confirms that eretz is taken from an unused root, probably. It means to be firm, the earth at large, or positively a land, times common, country, earth, field, ground, land, times nations, way plus wilderness. So if we quote a couple examples, you'd like to see in Genesis 19:31, God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, and Lot's daughter said, "There's not a man in the earth, eretz, to come in unto us." The daughters were talking about a geographical area. And in Luke chapter 2, verse 1, it refers to a decree that would out to tax the whole world. But this only refers to the territories that the Romans controlled. We're not talking about the planet Earth. And our last quote is from Genesis 41:56. It says, "The famine was over all the face of the earth." You recall in the story about Joseph that there was a famine in the land. Well, the famine was only in Israel and Egypt, and it did not go around the whole planet or the geographical earth. Our next consideration is very important, and I'd like you to listen and read very carefully. The Hebrew word translated covered is kasa. This covering can be defined in any of three ways. One, residing upon. Two, running over. Or three, falling upon. The distinction among these definitions are very important. Kasa can be interpreted to mean that more than 20 feet of water stood, that is, remained over the high hills or mountains. Or it could mean that this quantity of water either ran over them, as in a flash flood, or fell upon them as rainfall. The context gives no clear indication which of the three meanings to choose. Not that the choice is significant for understanding the effects of such covering. Any of the three scenarios would guarantee total destruction, no survivors. Because this is an important point, I'm going to state that I have five authorities to say that this would be the right way to translate this scripture. And the record states mountains were covered. That meant they were covered with the deluge, the rain, but not submerged. I'm going to repeat that again. The record states that the mountains were covered, but that meant that they were covered with the deluge, the rain, but not submerged. And this would be in Palmelli's book, Brother Palmelli, on page 233. So the authorities, I know that this is an important point and some will challenge it or question it, so I have five authorities to show that the mountains were not submerged. I have Dr. Hugh Ross, who is a scientist and a theologian, Brother Palmelli, Bernard Ram, William Tatter, and Derek Dean. Proof that the flood was local. The mountains should be hills. The earth should be local or occupied land. Covered means water fell upon hills and mountains. Now to use scriptures, in Genesis 7, it does not necessarily claim that the water stood above the highest mountains. Rather, it says that an enormous deluge fell upon or ran over or covered the highest hills visible to Noah. And in Psalms 104, verse 9, we have a scripture to confirm this, and it states that when God made dry land appear on creation day number 3, Genesis 1:9, that never again will the waters cover the earth. Our next consideration is that olive leaves do not grow at high altitudes, nor could they survive a global flood. This is a very crucial point to our discussion. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take some research on olive trees. And this comes from an Italian article, and bless the Italians for this. At 400 meters above sea level, this zona limite, or limited zone, is the highest elevation for growth in the Mesopotamia, in the Mediterranean region. The unique microclimate with constant air currents keeps our insects and eliminate the need for pesticides, allowing the 100% biological production. So what I did is I converted the 400 meters. And the 400 meters means that at 1,320 feet above sea level, that is the limit, the exact limit where olive trees will grow. Our next consideration, I start thinking about our Lord at the Garden of Gethsemane. Now, this applies only to the Jerusalem area alone. The Mount of Olives extends about a mile from northeast to southwest and has four summits. According to a recent survey, the highest and most northerly of these eminences rise to an elevation of 2,963 feet above the level of the Mediterranean Sea, or more than 400 feet above the general elevation of Jerusalem. So this is the highest place where you'd see olive trees grow. And we have a spread now of water height that could go from 20 to 23 feet as the lowest level and below 2,963 feet above sea level. And this comes from the Aid to Bible Understanding, page 1251. Now we're going to submit some crucial evidence, and this is taken from William Tanner, who is a geologist. Various people have discussed these points, hills, all, and land, before, but it is popular to sweep logical discussion to one side, perhaps because logic without facts may not carry much weight. But in the present case, we have two important details that are undeniably part of the record, and they shed a great deal of light on the story. Now, these two specific and pertinent factual statements in the Genesis account do not depend on our ability to evaluate properly the sophistication of the writer. One is the fact listed above that the water rose 15 cubits, and that would be from 20 to 23 feet, and this places a limit to the flood height. The other is the statement that a dove, having been released from the ark, brought back a freshly plucked olive twig, and that really should be a leaf. All the translations say leaf. Fleshly plucked means green in the parlance of today. If the leaf or twig were brown, that would be freshly plucked would be an error. Now he has a little dry, sarcastic humor. Obviously, Noah did not think that the olive tree was growing in a suitable tub on the ark. Therefore, it must have been located somewhere else. It is not permissible to infer that the olive tree, still bearing green leaves, was newly exposed by the falling water level after some 5 months of submergence. Tree leaves must breed, taking in air for the carbon dioxide contact and exhaling oxygen. This is done through the stomata. And you see this is the key word. Stoma means one mouth opening, and stomata means many mouth openings. And these are numerous tiny openings that are present on the underside of a leaf, as well as, for example, on the stem. It's easy to kill a leaf and do it quickly by coating the underside with paint or varnish, thus plugging the stomata. Trees which are covered by water for much less than 150 days die. They can't breathe. The cover leaves die almost immediately. One does not have to paint the leaves of living tree to learn this. Many a modern flood has left ample evidence. So what we're trying to illustrate is that the flood was local, not global. The flood covered the essential region of the planet, not global. And the wind, which I think is one of the key points to prove that it was a local flood, God used the wind to remove the flood waters, and we're going to illustrate that shortly. and the waters rose from 20 to 23 feet. And you'll notice that on this picture, Mount Ararat is close to 17,000 feet. And at the present time, I'm talking about the present time, if you were close to the top, it would be minus 45 degrees. Plus, the air is very, very thin. And you have to be trained to be at such a high elevation. So in our translation of Genesis 8:4, it says the ark landed on the mountains and hills. And so we prefer that it would be the hills. And this would include a very, very large area that you see on our drawing. So what we're trying to prove now is that olive leaves, trees, will not grow in a flood area. So the olive trees do not grow in high elevations. So the olive trees would grow at a very, very low elevation. And the olive trees would not survive a global flood. Next, we have the miracle of stomata. Tree leaves must breathe, taking in air for the carbon dioxide center and exhaling oxygen. This is done through the stomata, Greek, mouth, numerous openings underside of the leaf. Last Sunday, I asked Brother Peter Karavis, who is Greek, I said, Peter, do you know what stomata means? He said, yes, I do. He says, stoma, which is a mouth opening, he said they use that in a context that the parents will tell their children, shut your stomata. In other words, shut your mouth. So I want you to always remember this word, stomata. It means mouth. And I talked to Brother Leo Stephanidis this morning. I asked him, do you know what stomata means? And he says yes. And that, it means the mouth. So this is the key to the whole talk, that the leaves must breathe. The dove was gone for the ark for a few hours because, according to Genesis' account, it returned the same day. This means that the green olive tree could have been tens of kilometers away, or perhaps as much as 100. At that distance, the land had not been covered by the Noachian deluge because tree leaves were still green. So this is my conclusion from all the material that I have. It says, therefore, olive trees will not grow above 3,000 feet above sea level. Now, that's being generous because that's the Jerusalem area. Thus, the water level of the flood could not have been higher than 3,000 feet. If it was, the dove could have not found a fresh olive leaf. So we had the Italian article saying that it would be 1,200 feet would be the extent of the growth of the olive tree. What we're going to do is go through a sequence of events, and we're going to give you our version of how we think the flood took place. God told Noah to build an ark. It's also possible, as a possibility, that he may have had help building the ark. And I'd also like to suggest a possibility that the ark could have been one half the size, because we normally think of it with the cubits. But if you think of a cubit being only 9 inches instead of 18 inches, the ark would have been one half of the size. And I prefer that thought. For our next illustration, God told Noah to load up the animals. And a smaller ark could easily contain 288 clean and unclean animals. And this is based upon Deuteronomy chapter 14, verses 5 and 6, and Leviticus chapter 11, verses 4 to 19. Next on our map, we'd like to illustrate that Noah lived in this area where you see the star. That is where the ark was built. And you'll notice that this would be 100 to 150 miles, and there are no hills, there are no mountains in this area. Our next consideration would be that the ark, when it went up, would move toward the east. And then we had 40 days of rain and 40 days of a tsunami, what we have recently in Indonesia. So that means there was rain for 40 days over this area, plus it could have been over the whole world. But the tsunami took place from the Persian Gulf going through this whole area for 40 days. And from Noah's view of the horizon, when he would go up in this area, again, I asked Brother Russ Martin, he said from that ark, he could only see about 15 miles around here. Even if we were generous to increase it, he would not see anything but water. And then our key point that convinces me that this was a local flood was God caused a wind. The wind would come down from the mountains and push all the water back into the Persian Gulf. I really like that point because for me it's very simple and logical that this was not a global wind. Our next example would be a dove flies above the waters and comes back. So from the dove's perspective of looking all around the horizon, he doesn't see anything. And a dove can travel 100 to 600 miles at a peak of 60 miles per hour. Our next consideration would show that this is where Noah built the ark, and the ark moved toward the east. Because you remember, we have a scripture that says that after the flood, they came from the east. Now we have a picture of the dove coming back with a fresh olive leaf, and that olive leaf would be stomata, and it has to be a fresh leaf that was not under water. And the key part about this is that it came back toward the evening. The reason it had to come back toward the evening would be is that doves have a natural built-in navigational system. Somehow they could tell where they're at by the sun. So it came back toward the evening because if the sun would go down, the dove would not know where it's at. Our next consideration would be all the animals would be on deck getting fresh air, rejoicing that the flood is going to be over, and they're looking at the sun, and you could also see a picture of the rainbow. Next, they're unloading and getting off of the ark, and it notices even this drawing is good because it shows that it's like some type of a small hill. Next, this would be Noah offering up a sacrifice to God, and then we have the picture, a wonderful picture of the rainbow. And this again would be Noah standing on the side. It is very appropriate again that we have like a little hill here, and the animals are getting off of the ark. And you'll notice in the background, which they would be very close to those mountains that would be toward the east, that these might be higher mountains over to the side. And we have Revelation 4:3, and he was sitting, and he who was sitting was like a jasper stone and a sardis in appearance. And there was a rainbow or a halo around the throne, like an emerald green in appearance. And this is taken from reprint 529, paragraph 9. The throne is encircled by a rainbow, like unto an emerald, and a rainbow is a token of a covenant. Now, this is a paraphrase of what you see here. The green or emerald color probably symbolizes freshness and vigor, that God's plans are like nature in the springtime, filled with life and continually developing and unfolding, blossoming into luscious fruit for the sustenance and pleasure of his creatures. Next, we have a drawing of the throne scene. You will notice that these are the four attributes of God. The lion would represent justice, man would represent love, the eagle would represent wisdom, and the ox would represent strength. And next we have a picture of a rainbow. If you were standing on a mountain, due to all of the reflection and the refraction that you would see here, it's possible that you could see a full a rainbow. But we'd also like to mention that this rainbow looked like the emerald that was the prevailing color was a pleasant green to show the reviving and refreshing nature of the new covenant. And this is an outstanding quote from Matthew Henry in his commentary. It says, this rainbow looked like the emerald. The most prevailing color was a pleasant green to show the reviving and refreshing nature of the new covenant. So this rainbow, the color that would be around the throne would be the green, which would be restitution. Next we have an illustration from Isaiah chapter 11 verse 6. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and a young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And this would also be true from Acts 3:19 to 21, which would be the time of refreshing or restitution of all things. In the second volume, on the bottom of the page, there is a word prosopon, and that means that when Christ would return, this would also be God's face turning toward mankind. And Hosea chapter 2, verses 18 to 23 would be the new covenant with animals. And this would be the fulfillment of Genesis chapter 9, where God said he will make a new covenant with all flesh. This is the end, and may the Lord bless you and keep you. And if you have any questions, I hope I could answer. I'll try to answer any questions that you have. Anyone have a question? Yes, Brother Joe.
Hello.
You mentioned before the possibility that the cubit might be 9 inches rather than the traditional 18 inches most of us are familiar with. Is there any support for that thought in history or archaeological research that would indicate that the cubit might have been 9 inches instead of 18?
No, there really isn't, Joe, except that some commentaries will suggest that due to the humongous size of the ark that we are fixed in to thinking that it is cubits. So they would suggest that it could have been a span. This is that, my own thought, that it would be a span, and it would be half the size. And then if you take all the animals that would be mentioned, clean and unclean animals, it comes out to be 288 animals. And they divided up half the ark, and they said it would be more than enough room for all of the animals and also for all of the feed to take care of all the animals. And being a carpenter, I personally prefer the smaller size, because if you're used to construction, especially to build something at that time, I think half the size would be more than sufficient. So it's really from suggestions from commentaries. Yes, Sister Elfrida.
Well, I somehow don't thinking too, because from the scriptures that I read, there Noah could not open up or go on the deck, so to speak. Would he have needed the water for the animals too? That would increase the size of the ark, because he just didn't open the window and dipped out some water from the flood.
Yeah, okay. So what we have for that, Sister Alfreda, is that it is suggested, and God seemed to overrule from the standpoint that they didn't have electricity on the ark. And it's very possible that on the ark you didn't have a lot of light. So all the animals were in hibernation. So that would mean they would take a lot less in quantities of food and also in quantities of water. So the explanation that I would offer would be that they were in hibernation and God overruled that the supplies that Noah would take would be sufficient. They made it, so we know it worked. Yes, Brother Chris Mapczynski.
So do you have any thoughts, Brother Irwin, about
why it was it necessary for Noah to take the animals into the ark if the nature of the flood was local, where, you know, really, even if he didn't take them, their existence wouldn't be threatened. I guess that's the reason why we think that it was a global flood, because he would take the animals that needed to continue their existence. On the other hand, I know that it is hard to picture that all the species and all the animals that exist now could have fit into the ark. So that's been usually a question on my mind. But anyway, any thoughts on why it was commanded to him to take the animals on the ark?
Okay, this is one of the arguments that they bring up to show that it was not a local flood, it was a global flood, because there would be no reason to build a big ark. And what I'd offer as a suggestion is that they lived on a flat plain. At that point in time, they were not interested in living in the hills or in the mountains. So all the animals would be in the low level. And God would have to specifically do something to tell all of the animals to go and climb all the mountains, get out of here. So he would have to direct them to get out of that low plain. They were in a low plain. The closest hills or mountains were within 100 or 150 miles away. And I think the Tower of Babel proves that they loved to live in a Babylonian area because it was very fertile. They had no problem growing any type of vegetables and so forth. So civilization concentrated on living in the low area. So in order for God to save the animals that would be within the range of this whole Mesopotamia area, which would be very large, he would have to somehow warn all these animals to go and run for the hills. Any other questions? Yes, Brother Edmund Jesuit.
Brother Irwin, could you tell us when this idea first came into being? Now, I don't know what the dates are of all these authors and these people that are suggesting this, but with the time of knowledge that it was going to be increased now, did that have an influence on some of these writers? How soon did this idea surface that it was just local? Because up until now, I think everyone, all in the religious world, all believed that it was complete, judging by the fact that the mountains, why they would think mountains of, well, wherever they are on the earth, they would be covered. But specifically, when did this begin to finally take hold?
Okay, I would like to state I don't know exactly all of the historical background, but I do know that Brother A.O. Hudson, who just died several years ago at about the age of 100, he was the editor and author of Bible Student Monthly. Years ago, in 1976, I was a subscriber to his magazine, and I read his article called Ararat Urartu. I read that article, and it just staggered my mind, and I read it the second time, I read it the third time, and I was convinced that he was right. And he suggested that the ark landed on the mountains, plural. There's an S. You look in your Bible, it says that the ark landed on the mountains. So he suggested, he went through quite a bit of historical background, that as the time went on, they carried this tradition up further north to make it more glamorous and for the tourists, that they moved it all the way up to Mount Ararat. And he said, this is not the case. And then he illustrated in his magazine to show that the face of the ziggurats pointed toward the east, toward this mountain called Kui Anaram. And he also brought up the scripture in Genesis 11:2. It's not in all the translations. Much to my amazement, the King James translation is accurate. It says that after the flood, they came from the east. So Brother Hudson opened up the door. Now, I don't know if many others knew about this before him. But after that, Hugh Ross, who is a scientist and a theologian, I heard him speak twice. And he tries to show that the Bible and science are in harmony with one another. And he confirms in his book, just the record of Genesis, that the word mountains means a complete range. And he favored the thought that the ark landed by Nineveh, because there are some hills around Nineveh, and you're approaching a mountainous area. So he favored Nineveh. So that's another possibility. Then Brother Paul Malley said in his book, which is a fantastic point, and the other authors say the same thing, to cover something is totally different than to submerge something. So that means I could cover that table here with water, but it does not mean that the water is standing 15 cubits above that table. And then there were two other men, Brahm, and I can't remember the name of the other gentleman, but there have been men coming on the scene who are stating that this would be very accurate. And then according to the archaeological discoveries of artifacts, they found that all of the artifacts that came before the flood were by a city called Kish, K-I-S-H. That would be right by the Babylonian area. And it also came from the city of Pharaoh, where we believe Noah built the ark. And it also came from Ur, where Abraham lived. So you have three cities to confirm that it was in a very low area to show that the artifacts of the flood came from this area. So there have been other men. I can't quote all the men that would support this, but there are other men, without quoting their names, to show that when you are thinking geographically at that time, the world was Egypt, Israel, and Babylon. It was not the United States of America, South America, or Australia. It was not any of these countries. Earth represented the Mesopotamian area, and that's why they say that you have to think in context of that Mesopotamian area. So, Brother Edmund, I don't have a sequence of what happened, but I know A.O. Hudson was probably one of the pioneers, and after that, many individuals have picked up on it, and they expanded on it, and I think that they're bringing out a great deal of information, and the men that I quoted are very qualified and skilled in their areas, and even as Brother Russ said, if you're on water, you could only see 15 or 20 miles. So the water could only be 10, 20, 30 feet. It doesn't have to be very deep. All you're going to see is water. You're going to be cut off by the curvature. So, Edmund, I don't know what the sequence would be, but I know for sure it started in 1976 and forward. Maybe there have been some before that. I don't know.
Brother Irwin?
Yes.
Sister Alice in the back.
Oh, yes, Sister Alice.
Thank you for the opportunity of questions and answers. I would recommend that the brethren look up the Genesis flood and look up Frank Morris. And there are a lot of quotations of fish bones and crocodiles and amphibians that have been found up in the mountains over 1,300 feet high. And this strata is all over the world, not just in one place. Plus the mastodons, it shows like a catastrophe happened all over the world with these animals at that level. Also, in respect to when this came up, this actually is a higher critic theory from the 1700s. It was way before Brother Hudson wrote it. And the local flood theory was grasped by many geologists to disprove the Bible. So I would recommend that the brethren look it up and get the other side of the story. As far as having different animals on the ark, the Genesis kinds can fit on the ark. It's when you have all the species that are so multiple, and those that happen with crossing within the kind.
Sister Alice, I'd like to mention that I have this book by Morris. It is a very good book. He is a trained engineer of some kind, and he does favor a global flood. And I would like to say that it does not mean that the 40 days of rain did not cause some havoc on the earth. The Bible doesn't say that. It just said we know there was a water rain that Brother Russell suggests that came down. But in his book, he cannot explain the fresh olive leaf. He has to admit that he can't explain it. His answer is that after the flood, this fresh olive leaf sprouted out, and William Tanner and all he has to say, no way, after being underwater for 5 months, that you could come up with a fresh olive leaf. So there has to be other explanations that why certain things happen in certain ways, but I think the olive leaf, the Sumatra, definitely proved beyond a shadow of a doubt to me, that there was a local flood. Brother Joe Migas, and then we'll have to turn it over to Brother Nails.
Sorry for speaking twice, but one of the more romantic notions that Bible students who favor the global flood theory hold is that Noah's Ark is still preserved today in some inaccessible crevasse of those tall mountains in southeastern Turkey, the traditional location of Mount Ararat, and that it will be discovered in the kingdom. God will reveal its location. Mankind will be able to see it as an artifact of the truth of the Bible historical account. I guess this is more of a statement than a question. If the Ark traveled the short distance, as you described, confined to that more or less flat plain area, then the Ark is probably not hidden and still preserved and was probably discovered and disassembled. Do you have any thought on that about the Ark and its end?
Yes. I'm going to raise my wife up to a new height. My wife said to me, you know, Erwin, if that Ark landed in any area that was very low, they would have taken all the lumber, taken it apart, and used it to build homes. And this is the exact thought that Hugh Ross has in his book. If it landed on very low ground by the Nineveh area, it would have been history by taking it apart and using it, because that lumber certainly would be, reuse it. I'm sorry to cut you short, Leo. I have to turn it over to Brother Ken. I'm convinced myself that, not because I presented this, but from what I showed for the gentleman, I'm convinced that it was a local flood, and may the Lord have his blessing.